Thank you very much. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here. This is my first time. I arrived yesterday. I can already see it's a really exciting place and really intellectual, I think, as opposed to doing experiments in the dark room all the time. Also, I'm kind of glad that I'm giving 1 hour and a half, and I tried to give a similar talk before. It would never worked out because just never have enough time to finish all the slides I want to give, I want to show, but this is a good opportunity. What I wanted to do is to talk about a single cell type in the retina, and try to use this as an example to bridge a few fronts. One is development of the retina, which is the thing that I'm gonna talk about is the population propagating activity in the retina, so-called retinal waves. And use that particular cell type, the Stabilis Amacrine cell, try to illustrate how a single cell, and which forms a network, can perform different tasks at different times during development and also in the adult during visual processing. So I'm really glad that Winfried gave a wonderful talk yesterday and gave a nice introduction, sort of, to my presentation today. So what I'm gonna show you here is just a... Sorry. Oops. Okay, this is isolated retina from a human, and you can see it's a very thin piece of tissue. It's like a brain slice. It's actually thinner than most of the brain slices. It's only 150 micron or so. And here is the macular region, and if somebody has macular degeneration, and that's where it occurs first, and optic nerve head. So if you take a cross-section of the retina, and you see a structure, a layered structure, which was described by the name is lost here, John Dowling, in the 60s, that light comes in from the ganglion cell layer, goes through the inner plexiform layer, and inner nuclear layer, outer plexiform layer, and then the photoreceptor cell layer. So the signal is then back-propagated this way from the signals generated by rods and cones are transmitted to the second-order neuron, which are bipolar cells, horizontal cells, amacrine cells, and then sent to the ganglion cells. Ganglion cell axons form the optic nerve, which relays the signal to the brain. So the structure of the retina was recognized 100 years ago by Cahill. And in his drawing already, you can see rods and cones and quite a number of bipolar cell types now. Now we know there are about 12 or so bipolar cell types in mammalian retina. And then also you can see this morphology of different types of amacrine cells. Depicted here are about somewhere between half a dozen to eight. Now we know from several groups that several laboratories, particularly Dick Maslin's lab, which shows there are about 35 types of amacrine cells. Each type of amacrine cell has its unique morphology corresponding, as we believe, a particular type of function. Now, these signals are then converged onto somewhere between 12 to 20 types of ganglion cells, and the axon leaves the retina. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is during development, and again, it's shown this slide from Dick Maslin's early work in the 70s, that if you look at rabbit retina, when the rabbits are born at postnatal day zero, the retina is quite immature. You can see the cone photoreceptors are differentiated, the rods are not. Bipolar cells are barely differentiated, and not quite. The ganglion cells and the amacrine cells are differentiated at that time, and actually they are making early synapses. So it's the early type of synaptogenesis. There are two types of synapses in the retina, and one is called a ribbon synapse from bipolar cells to the ganglion cells, and also from photoreceptor cells to the bipolar cells. Here you can see a ribbon, and on it, a lot of vesicles are docked. So, but the amacrine cells, the synapses made from amacrine cells onto ganglion cells and the bipolar cells are conventional synapses, which don't have a ribbon structure. So, as you can see, so this is the time of eye opening of P11. So, during this 1 or 2 week of time, the retina is actually matured. And by time of eye opening, light responses start to occur. And then by P18 or P21, the retina is essentially functionally mature. So one thing we looked at is the time period between postnatal day 0 and postnatal day 11 or so, and see what happened to the retina. As you will know, as you can see from this slide, the cells, cones are differentiated, but the connections are not actually made. So you wouldn't expect any light responses at this time. So what happened to yes? That's the next slide I'm going to show. Actually, well, so to answer your question, Marcus Meister, Rachel Wang, and Carlos Yates, and Dennis Dacey first found in late 1990s or early 2000, early 1990s, is that they used a multi-electrode array to record from retinal neurons at this age in ferret. What they found is there's this spontaneous activity propagating in the form of waves. So I showed this slide, which is done by my son, who was a high school student. We just bought a multi-electrode array, so his task was to reproduce that. Yes? Well, you can probably see from this movie, which I'm going to reproduce the result, is that if you just leave, you don't really need to do anything. That's why high school. You mean during dissection or something like that, or maybe spreading depression or something like that, hasn't been well actually. A face lab, I think, did that also at the same time. There was a science paper doing in vivo recording from the optic nerve They saw similar rhythmic activity. So that's probably the best I can say, other than the in vitro isolated retina. So Elton did was put the retina on the multi-electrode array and just watch it goes. It's not going. Okay, anyway, I guess I had a virus on my laptop before I came, so this is the backup laptop. Doesn't have enough memory. I don't think it can play the movie, sorry. But anyway, you will see that the activity propagates from one area. This is about 1 millimeter across of a rabbit retina. So the activity propagates in a waveform, and so this is since then being studied quite extensively by many laboratories, Rachel Wang, Marla Ferrer, and a number of laboratories, to show that with calcium imaging, you can see actually there is a dynamics, a very interesting dynamic of these waves. So this is one, for example, if the movie plays. This is with calcium imaging. So the cell was loaded. I'm sorry about this. It was playing just a minute ago. I don't know if it's going to take a long. Yeah, but it's probably. Let me just show here. It was playing just now here. Yeah, okay. So this is a wave propagating from this end downward, and you can see a demarcation here. There's a borderline here. Now the next wave comes in within like 20 seconds or so. It's shown here and avoids this upper region. So they observe a very nice boundary between the two regions. And if you can,
this is looking down.
This is looking down on the ganglion cell layer. So you load the retina with a calcium indicator dye and you use a low magnification, in this case a 10x lens, and you see 1 millimeter size of a retina. And you basically don't have to do anything, just keep the retina happy with physiological solutions and the temperature. And then if you...
Come back and show us your son's video too.
It's not
working. It's probably working this way.
Oh, yeah, okay. Let me finish this one first. So now you see two waves. They collide and annihilate each other. So suggesting there is a refractory process, that after the retina is excited for a brief of period of time, then there's a refractory process which cannot support a wave. And this is just a cross-section of E29, which is 2 days before birth. And you can see the cells, the outer retina and much of the inner retina, the cells are not differentiated. Only the ganglion cells and the amacrine cells are just differentiated. Let me see if I can show the earlier movie in this panel. Yes, here is a wave that he just recorded. Okay, so... the dark wave is produced by Fura-2 dye, which, you know, the fluorescence goes down when the calcium concentration goes up. So the question here is, what's the function of the wave? That has been studied by Karloff, Schertz, and several other laboratories. And the general idea is the spontaneous activity, like the visually driven activity, has some role in the connection of the visual system. So when the eyes, the two eyes, the ganglion cell sends the axons to the brain, they target on the lateral geniculate nucleus, and on the LGN, there are eye-specific segregations, or eye-specific layers. So you have left eye, right eye segregation. And this segregation turned out to be disturbed or very much disrupted if you block this spontaneous activity, suggesting that early neuronal activity plays a role in refinement of synaptic connections. And this is actually not unique to the retina. It's being found, it's probably first found in the retina, but now it's being found in hippocampus, in the cortex, in many other auditory systems, spinal cord. So this is a general phenomenon that spontaneous activity helps the connection during visual system development. So my laboratory is not an anatomical laboratory, so we don't really know how to find the LGN, to be honest with you. So we don't really look into the layers. We don't look into the layers in the retina. We rather were interested in the mechanism, how this remarkable event or phenomena is generated in the retina. So to look at the wave, three questions pop up immediately. One is how the wave is initiated, and how the activity is propagated, and then what caused this rhythmicity. So some clue came early on by this finding from Malafella and the Karloff Schertz laboratory in 1996, where they had this cover story in Science showing that the waves are actually blocked by nicotinic receptor antagonist. Nicotinic receptor is one type of acetylcholine receptor. And when they use the drug Curare to apply to the retina, the waves are simply blocked. And this was immediately reproduced here by my laboratory in the rabbit retina, because again, I'm not showing any of those slides by pioneers like Karloff Schertz laboratory's work, simply because I want to be consistent, and all the slides shown here are on rabbit, which was done in my laboratory. So by recording from a retinal ganglion cells, you can see that they receive those barrage of synaptic inputs every minute or so. And this activity is indeed blocked by blocking the nicotinic receptors, suggesting that somehow acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter, classic fast excitatory neurotransmitter, is involved in generating this activity. And the reason we got into this is we've been recording from starburst cells since my postdoctoral years. And this is very exciting because we know there's only one type of cholinergic neuron in the retina. And that happens to be the cell that I've been studying. So next slide shows the cholinergic amacrine cell. Okay, sorry. Okay, so now these cells are called cholinergic because they use the cholinergic antibodies to acetylcholine esterase, we found two populations of cells. One is the classic American cell located in the inner part of the in the nuclear layer, and another population is, for all intents and purposes, they're identical, but it's a mirror symmetric population with the cell body displaced to the ganglion cell layer. These are called displaced amacrine cells. They turn out to be very useful because you can use the electrode to record them much more easily than those cells. So most of the, nearly all of the recordings we made are from displaced amacrine cells. Now, these cells have a several very remarkable characteristics. One is that they ramify very narrowly in two bands in the plexiform layer where the synapses are made between the bipolar cells, amacrine cells, and the ganglion cells. So in the synaptic layer, there are two bands suggesting that the cells are narrowly stratifying. And if you look at the whole mount retina, these cells are identified with a semi-regular spacing between cells. Now, if you actually go in and fill these cells with electrode, what you find is breathtaking morphology, and that's so-called the starburst morphology, which was done by several groups, Dick Maslin's lab, David Vanney's lab, and Heinz Wessely in 1983 or so. And Ted Famiglietti is the one who's coined the cell starburst amacrine cell because of its obvious morphology. Now you can see these cells contact each other. And this is just a random filling of six cells in space. So you can actually fill more cells. There are more cells than is shown. And if you do so, and as shown by Tauchi and Maslin, that these cells form a very tight, a very highly overlapping network. And the network is formed by those honeycomb-like loops. And this is, again, a very unique cell in the retina. If you think about a cell, yesterday we heard from Fred's talk, in a single neuron may do something important to the brain. And indeed, if you look at the ganglion cells in the retina, they tau the retina, so they have minimal overlap. Each cell is responsible for a particular spot in the visual field. So any signal coming in from a particular part of the visual field is received by a ganglion cell. A type of ganglion cell. There are many types, but each type is tiring the retina. So one cell is responsible for area in the visual field. Now, this amacrine cell is highly unusual, that if you put a needle just on the retina, you just poke into the retina, you're going to hit one ganglion cell by the tiring property. But for the starburst cell, you're going to hit somewhere between 30 to 70 starburst amacrine cells. Yes. Okay, I'm sorry, yes. Yeah, so what they did, it was just injecting many starburst cells, actually not many, in here probably half a dozen or so, but very closely spaced. So what you see are the processes from six starburst cells overlapping on each other. So you can see like here, you can see several processes suggesting they are from different cells. If you look at the starburst cell itself, the dendrites don't cross each other. Within one cell, its own dendrites doesn't cross each other, right? But you can see a lot of overlapping here, and that from neighboring cells. They are making synaptic contacts. That's part of a majority of the talk that I'm going to talk about today. And so just from six cells, you can see quite a lot of overlap. But what I'm trying to say is the overlapping factor is as much as 30 to 70. So if you put a needle through and poke it, you're going to hit 70 cells, as many as 70 cells. And that property is quite unusual, and it has been puzzling why starburst cells have to have such a high overlapping factor compared to a ganglion cell, for example, which has a coverage factor of 1. So now, to talk about the wave mechanism, talk about the rhythm that I just mentioned. Once a minute or so, this rhythmic activity. And if you look at the rhythmic activity like this in a biological system, the first thing you think about is the pacemaking activity in your heart, except the time scale is very different. The heart beats every second or so, but this beats every minute. So we have to account for this low rhythmicity to start with. So one thing so Manoffera had a model which proposed that the activity probably is generated in endocrine cell layer, and then somehow read out by the ganglion cells through a filter. So her idea at that time was the activity, this is a two-layer model. In the ganglion, in endocrine cell layer, the activity probably is very rapid, is highly rhythmic, the periodicity is pretty high. But somehow through the filtering here, the activity is spaced out so that you get, only when you synchronize enough of activity in the endocrine cells do you get a wave in the ganglion cells. So the slowness of this wave every minute or so is perhaps due to the coupling or this filter between stop between endocrine cells and the ganglion cells. So we first test this idea. Overlap of one, that's right.
But the endocrine cell layer, its scheme is not consistent with what you told us about overlap.
Yeah, so that's true. So particularly for this endocrine cell type, the Stabos endocrine cell. So we don't really know the coverage factor of many other endocrine cells. There are 35 types of it. I doubt they have such high overlapping factor, but the small cells actually they are quite, some of the cells tile the retina. When I say ganglion cells, they are not just one type. Each type tile, but there are 14 types, and some of them do overlap somewhat. So we want to test if there are two-layer models. So the way to do it is we record from an endocrine cell and the ganglion cell simultaneously to see how they propagate into, how they behave during the wave, and it turned out that they synchronized. And this is also shown by another method that we used, that was first developed by Gang and Rachel Wang. That is, they can code, this is a DNA gun which shoots out small gold particles of 1 micron or so diameter. And then typically people code these particles with DNA and you shoot into the cell, into the nucleus, and then you transfect the gene. Now, Rachel and the gang, Wenbiao Gang discovered in Woodhull that they can code these particles with fluorescent dyes. And that's another way of introducing a dye to the cell. And we use this method and shoot, all you need is just a particle coated with the calcium-sensitive dye, and when the particle gets into the cytosol, the cell is filled. And then if the movie plays again, which I kind of doubt. Sorry, yeah, it doesn't play. But anyway, maybe I can play in the other way. Okay, you can see. This is sped up by 10 times. Every minute or so, there is a wave. The cell just light up. And in between waves, you can see some, I don't know if you can see some local activity. Okay, so there are two types of activity. One is a localized calcium rise, and the other one is a global activity and corresponding to wave. But anyway, based on the frequency of these bursting activities, we conclude that endocrine cells and the ganglion cells are actually participating in the same way. There's no two layer there to it. Okay, so so then the popular model for this retinal wave at the time was the following. First, it was assumed that the waves are mediated by an early network formed by recurrent excitatory synapses. So when you look at the synapses in an early system like this, you have common neurotransmitters, glutamate and acetylcholine, which are excitatory neurotransmitters. But there are also inhibitory neurotransmitters such as GABA and glycine. Those receptors are choroid channels. But because the choroid concentration in the cell is very high during early development due to a lack of a particular choroid transporter, so these neurotransmitters are actually excitatory during early development. So you have a system of all excitatory neurotransmitters producing something, epileptic. And that's the idea of those early spontaneous activity, which can occur spontaneously. So the second assumption of this activity is that the rhythm of the wave is determined by the network of, by the network homeostasis, such that synaptic depressions, for example, due to depletion of readily releasable pool of neurotransmitter, may cause the cell to be refractory. And then what initiates this activity was thought to be a random perturbation in the system. Yes? I mean, at this time, people didn't really know what kind of network, but it's the cells in the retina. Could be ganglion cells, could be the amacrine cells. And as I'm going to show later, and this turned out to be indeed the Starburst amacrine cell. Okay, so the idea is you have a network of recurrent synapses. But the problem is these synapses are excitatory, unlike the ones that Fred talked about yesterday. You have excitatory input and you have a recurrent inhibitory feedback to make the cell, to make the system stable. In this case, it's excitatory positive feedback, and by definition, this is not a stable state. So it's going to generate this rhythmic, generate this spontaneous burst of activity, and somehow, because at that time it was thought that the retina or the cells cannot release neurotransmitter very efficiently during early development, and there's a prolonged refractory process after this spontaneous burst, and then it becomes quiescent for a minute or so. And that was the theory for the generation of this rhythmic, slow rhythm of 1 minute or so. Okay, so we test these ideas. First, we want to know if there is a recurrent excitatory system or network in the retina. And to do this, the best target, of course, is the Starburst amacrine cell, which are the only cells releasing acetylcholine. So what we did was, in the whole mount retina, we can identify Starburst amacrine cell, which actually is not shown. It's buried under the ganglion cell layer, under the ganglion cell layer. Okay, so now if you recall from two Starburst amacrine cells, as you can see, simultaneously, then we can drive one cell to see if there's a response in the other cell. And that's indeed, I'm going to skip this slide, and that's indeed what we see. If you give a pulse to one cell, you generate a fast sodium current and then slow a calcium current followed by a number of calcium activated currents. So the cell is depolarized to from minus 70 to 0 millivolt or so. And then you see this in the other cell, you see a cholinergic input. We know it's cholinergic because we tested the pharmacological properties and ionic selectivity. We can identify this indeed is the cholinergic response. And we can do that to the neighboring cell, to this cell, evoke a release and a detect a response. So these cells are reciprocally exciting each other. Starburst cells are the only cell, or one of the few cells that so far we haven't found any gap junctions on them. So now you can hold the cell in a different potential where you can eliminate the excitatory currents. The currents you are measuring are inhibitory. And what you find is the Starburst cells also receive a GABAergic input to the stimulation of a neighboring cell. And that's, again, reciprocal. And this is something I haven't mentioned to you, and that is Starburst cells are unique in the sense that they release two neurotransmitters. That's against the Dale's principle, one neuron, one neurotransmitter. This is one of the few examples that a single neuron can release two neurotransmitters. In this case, excitatory and inhibitory. Yes? Okay, these cells are about 300 micron in diameter, so the space that you can go at most is about 300. They have to be overlapping. If they don't overlap, we don't detect the signal. Yes. So this shows that the Starburst cells indeed form a recurrent network. They can excite each other, they can also inhibit each other, but during early development, both neurotransmitters are believed to be acting as excitatory transmitters. So now, indeed, there is a network of recurrently connected excitatory synapses.
Sorry, I just didn't get what's
the left and the right. Oh, the left and the right, okay. So this is, the presynaptic cell is excited by the same way. The postsynaptic cell is held under voltage cap at two different voltages. This is at minus 70 millivolts.
I'm just asking, why is one depolarizing?
Okay, so this one is, the cell is held at 0 millivolt.
Oh, okay.
which is a different holding potential, there you get this outward current.
The gap of current,
well, we set it at minus 70 or so, depending on how much chloride you put in the pipette. So at this potential, you don't detect any gap of current. Yeah, that's another slide, a very good question. So now, if we recall from two cells, you have some other cells there too, right? So is the response monosynaptic or polysynaptic? Right, so you can imagine that the cell is excited here, you can have a synaptic transmission, but you can also have, especially since the synapses are excitatory, so this cell can excite a different cell, which in turn release a neurotransmitter onto here. This will be called polysynaptic interaction. So the way to rule out or to identify that the responses that we got are indeed monosynaptic, what we did was the following. We block synaptic transmission in the retina by cadmium, by blocking calcium channel. So all the neurons, they cannot release neurotransmitter in a calcium-dependent manner anymore. So, but how do we evoke the release from one stable cell? We play the trick by putting a caged calcium in the pipette. So only this cell, and then we uncage this calcium by UV. Since only this cell has caged calcium, so only one neuron in the retina can release neurotransmitter under this condition. So anything that we detect from the neighboring cell would have to be from this single amacrine cell. And indeed, if you do that, what we found is that you use 500 micromolar of cadmium to block calcium channels, and again, the nicotinic currents are detected, and at a different holding potential, in this case, plus 45, we see GABA currents. So that demonstrates that indeed, acetylcholine and the GABA are monosynaptically released in between stable cells. I don't know how much time.
Do you have a chance if there are packages in the standoff or if they're in isolated?
Yeah, yeah. So that's obviously a very interesting question, and hopefully towards the end of the talk I will address that. Okay. And this is another way to show that the stable cells not only release acetylcholine onto a neighboring cell, they actually have a feedback. So these are feedback receptor. Using the same method, you can block neurotransmission from all the other cells. You can uncage calcium from a single neuron, so cause it to release acetylcholine. And you can test if the same cell receive the effect of the neurotransmitter it released. So in this case, we uncaged calcium, or in this case, for example, we give a voltage pulse to depolarize the cell, and you activate some calcium activated currents. But now on the same cell, you detect some kind of synaptic events. And if you subtract from the baseline, you see these synaptic events, which can be blocked by acetylcholine nicotinic receptor antagonist, suggesting that this cell respond to the acetylcholine itself released. Now, this acetylcholine can, again, be from released from the same cell, or could be from a neighboring cell, right, through a feedback from a neighboring cell. But we again rule out the feedback from other cells by blocking calcium channels. So in other words, we demonstrate here, I'm probably losing you a little bit, but that's okay, it's not a major point here anyway. So the idea is to show that we indeed can detect autoreceptor, meaning the response of a stable cell to the neurotransmitter it released by itself. And that's not quite common, actually, considering this is an excitatory neurotransmitter. You don't usually have a positive feedback. But in the early development, during early development, the stable cells do have positive feedback by the neurotransmitter released by itself. Okay. So anyway, now we demonstrate that as a recurrent network can support propagation of excitation. And we want to see how many cells are required to do this. So in this case, we do a double patch recordings from one starburst amacrine cells, and this is from a neighboring starburst cell, recorded under two different conditions. This is under current clamp, looking at its voltage response during a wave. You have a burst of a spike, followed this by this plateau. On the other cell, on the neighboring cell, it's done under voltage clamp, looking at the synaptic input. So we know during a wave, the cell generate this burst and also receive this much synaptic input. We want to see how much this burst will cause neurotransmitter release to affect a neighboring cell by recording this waveform and artificially fed back into the cell so that this cell will behave like if it's during a wave. So we just voltage clamp by this simulated wave into this cell. And we can see, we want to see how much current is generated in a neighboring cell, which is very small. Okay. So this will be the input from this single cell during wave onto a neighboring cell. And we know that during a real wave, the cell receives that much current. So by a simple assumption that they are linearly summed, then we deduced that about 10 to 20 cells are required to generate this network activity. So now if we look at the starburst amacrine cell, they have an overlapping factor between 30 to 70. And if you fill one starburst cell here, that's the starburst cell. And now if you fill 10 neighboring cells, there'll be something like this. And if you fill 30 neighboring cells, they'll be like that. So we're thinking there is a network of something between here and here that supports the wave. Okay. Now this is of course the random overlay of starburst amacrine cell. In reality, they form much nicer, have this kind of honeycomb-shaped network. But anyway, this is the network we believe generates the retina wave. Yes. Oh, well, actually, we're only looking at the one type of amacrine cell. The other ones are not even considered here. So the idea we think is mainly generated by this network, and acetylcholine is released, and not the synapses are not so tight as we see classically a fast synaptic transmission. It probably involves extrasynaptic diffusion as well. So a lot of cells that are not tightly synaptically connected to this network can still receive cholinergic input. That's how almost every type of ganglion cell participate in the wave, and most of the amacrine cells we believe also participate in the wave. But anyway, this is sort of if it's a cartoon representation of a network that generates the retinal wave. And, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's something I'm going to talk about in a few slides down. We believe at this time the network is not so precise. Okay, those specific synapses are formed a little later. Okay, at this early age, and I'm going to show some evidence from morphologically. So to talk about this. So one way to check on this is to this is another slide I probably don't have time to cover, just to disprove that it's not due to synaptic depletion. Let me just go over this first. Okay, now we talk about the propagation of the wave by the starburst network, a recurring excitatory network, but it never addressed the question of initiation and the periodicity, and that's actually the key for a rhythmic event like that. Now, remember, the model was that it's due to synaptic depression, possibly caused by neurotransmitter depletion, and we test this idea by looking at the synaptic transmission immediately after the wave and immediately before a wave. We found that the synaptic strength is about the same, suggesting that neurotransmitter release is not depleted right after the wave. It's something else that produced this rhythmic activity, rhythm there. Yes. Yes. So then we after many years of recording from starburst cells, and most of the recordings were done in the voltage clamp, then this postdoc, Ji-Jen, found out that if he recorded the cell under current clamp, looking at the voltage responses, he found this very nice, very pronounced post-action potential, a hyperpolarization after hyperpolarization, which lasts many, many seconds. And this is quite unusual to have a hyperpolarization lasting somewhere on the order of 14 to 20 some seconds. And he wanted to make sure, he compared the starburst cell and the nearby ganglion cell, even though both cells participate in those wave activity, but only the starburst cell had this pronounced AHP after hyperpolarization potential. And he wanted to make sure that a single cell can do that by blocking all the neurotransmitter receptors that he can think of, block them all. And so pharmacologically, you sort of isolate the cell in the retina. And under this condition, he still sees that the rhythmic bursts, although the bursting bursts are a little faster without this plateau, but the rhythm maintains there. And this very much reminds of us a pacemaker. So this, but the difference is the pacemaking activity is very slow, on the order of 20 seconds. Because it's so rhythmic. I would say rhythmic, not necessarily pacemaker. The frequency is not so precise, but nevertheless, you see this rhythmic activity here.
And that's disconnected entirely?
This is disconnected entirely by the pharmacological blockers. And you can do that. This is not an artifact due to whole cell recording. You can do it on an on-cell recording, which you perturb the cell minimally. You can still see those rhythmic activities spontaneously occurring. And we believe these are the source of the, these are the pacemakers of the waves.
So they go into this very slow after
that, and then how long after that would they be then initiated? They can be quite regular. When the retina is preserved very well, you can have waves every 40 seconds or so. Yes, so this one is still similar to what you see during waves, although probably a little faster. So this is probably 30 seconds, 30 some seconds, and this is the 20, 30 seconds, and these are of course shorter, 20 seconds, and that could be about the frequency of the waves. Yes, so we believe these are generated by intrinsic currents of the cell. Oh, yes, yes, you're going to see all these. This is just another way of showing that using calcium imaging, I'm not going to get into. And this addresses some of your question. If you give a depolarization, you see a lot of spikes. Most of the spikes are calcium spikes. You block calcium channel, you see this blockade of this hyperpolarization. And if you give a more realistic depolarization, like you see during the wave, you can see the cell generate spikes around AHP and cadmium blocks it. And this is not this, so this AHP, this current is not due to the current you see in the heart muscle, H current, because that current is sensitive to cesium, whereas this current is not. And we found out this is in fact a potassium channel. It's a calcium activated potassium channel. So in this case, we again put caged calcium inside the cell, and you shine a UV to uncaged calcium, you see our potassium current. You can do that repetitively. You can also use voltage pulses to elicit a lot of, to open a lot of calcium channel to induce a calcium influx, which can again activate this potassium channel.
I'm surprised that it's not blocked by cesium.
I'm not quite surprised. This channel is, this is a low cesium, like one millimolar or so. So you can see this channel is actually opened by or activated by calcium, but also is regulated by cyclic AMP. In this case, we use voltage pulse to elicit this prolonged AHP. And then right before it's completely or fully developed, we uncage cyclic AMP in the cell using UV, and you can see this AHP is rapidly truncated. You can reproduce that repetitively. Now, this is very much matching the phenomena we found in retinal waves. We know that from Carla Schett's work, the waves are dramatically sped up by cyclic AMP or by phosphorylating or activating adenylate cyclase. So in fact, you can see these are the regular waves. If you put on phosphorylating, which is activates cyclic AMP in the cell, indeed, the recovery is much faster. You can get more frequent waves. Okay, so this concludes the first part of this talk. That is, we found out that there is an early network of the early network oscillation originates from intrinsic bursting activity of specific population of pacemaker cells, unlike the model which suggests that it's a homeostatic static system and due to depletion of a neurotransmitter. This is in fact produced by a specific type of cell which have the pacemaker capability. Now, these cells form a recurrently excitatory network that is coupled by reciprocal cholinergic synapses. They're also coupled by reciprocal GABAergic synapses. The exact role of GABA in early retinal wave is not clear, because if you block GABA receptors, the wave persisted pretty well. Now, the synaptic interaction in this network is synchronized and amplified by the connections between the starburst amacrine cell. And that's something I haven't really talked about. When the cell is excited, it receives cholinergic input from neighboring cell. There's an enhancement of activity. Okay, so the intrinsic activity is enhanced by network activity such that the activity is stronger and the calcium is lasting longer, and that produced a longer refractory process. So the wave frequency is further reduced from 20 seconds to about 40 seconds by the network. There is an interaction between intrinsic pacemaking activity and the network activity. Somebody has a question here. They have typical, the typical nicotinic receptor. It's not the alpha 7 type, and it has typical desensitization.
It should play some role too. There's a lot of acetylcholine sitting around it, right?
Yes, and it's quite, also esterase activity is very poor during this at this age. If you block the esterase, you don't affect this. So you can see that the acetylcholine actually sits around pretty long, and actually they diffuse some distance. And that's why we think it's not typically the classic synapses. It probably involve a lot of extrasynaptic interactions as well. We haven't tested by altering the desensitization, but the activity is propagated by activation, right? And once the cell activates, desensitization is not required, because the cell is depolarized, calcium comes in, and the refractory process is determined by a much longer kinetics, which is the calcium activated potassium channel. This is called the this channel, I don't think it has been cloned yet, but has a special name. It's called the KSAHP, simply because there's no other name for it. It's a slow after hyperpolarization current. It's called a KSAHP current. Sorry, I'm just in the back first. Yeah. Oh yeah, I have waves to show that it's like a two-dimensional plane wave propagating out. You have spiral waves, you have waves going all kinds of, and you can model if you want, you know, to get all these type of propagation patterns. Yeah, and that's something we looked into quite a bit. The propagation speed is about 200 micron per second, and we look at the bursting activity. The communication, cholinergic communication, is much faster than that. Okay, much of the time is spent by, the calcium signal inside the cell, the excitation inside the cell propagates very fast. So the cell is about 200 to 300 micron in diameter. So if one part is excited, it takes only a few milliseconds, hundreds of milliseconds to propagate to the other side. But the wave actually takes 1 second. And a lot of time is taken in between cells. So, and that's the slowness of the synaptic transmission, and due to, as we believe, perhaps extrasynaptic synaptic diffusion of that nature. Yes? Yes. Yeah, that's what I just said. So we believe the delay is between cells, not within the cell. Yeah. Yeah, but the stable cell has such big overlay, overlap. You have 70 cells that are not exactly synchronized. So you can have some, and you have 70, the average of 70 cells or 30 cells that can, you can, some cell just pop up a little earlier and some a little later. So you have this lag in between that can sort of smooth out. It's not like an action potential sort of, hopping from one node to the other. It's you have a network. So it's more continuous after averaging, I guess. Yes. They do. So it's determined by the past history. If this area that just experienced the wave, when a new wave arrives there, the cells are still probably under AHP. They're not enough to generate this spike again, so the wave will stop there. So you have to wait for this 20 to 40 second refractory process, which we believe is actually the AHP. So one cell should be enough to generate, right? Yeah. So I didn't qualify that. We initially thought it's about 10 to 20, but now we think it's probably less than that. And one is that the recordings are better, so we can get better, the actual response, the synaptic transmission between two cells are a little larger, so you don't need as many as 10 to. And another thing is, and I sort of alluded to somewhat, is that there's auto feedback too. So the nicotine that released can feedback and excite itself, so you don't need as many cells to input, but on the order of about 10 or so. And in fact, we occasionally saw that if you stimulate one starboard cell, you can generate a wave. Yes, so in reality, probably once the wave is initiated, it propagates to the neighboring cell. Yeah, you need that. So you need some kind of simultaneous activation of a few cells. And the number we think is not very large, somewhere on the order of 10 cells or so. And that can also slow down the periodicity because it's... Are inputting on every cell in this group. They are all connected to each other. So if one cell is excited, the other neighboring cells will be excited, and they go back and forth. I don't know. Perhaps I don't have a good explanation. I can speculate maybe there's a gradient of calcium stable amacrine cells, or there's a gradient of, I don't know if there's a particular molecule that modifies the neurotransmitter. But I think it was preferentially to the temporal or nasal, right? But Okay, yeah, but it's not very, it's rather subtle, is it, the biases? Yeah. But the wave should disappear too, right? Yeah. That's something we had, I didn't have time to talk about. There are three stages of waves. And when the stage two waves are blocked, you know, some other stages of wave are coming in that I'm not going to get into here. Yeah. Yes. We haven't tried that, but I think we would see that. Yeah, you can do something like that. From the second part of my talk, you will see that calcium actually does play a lot, important role in regulating the release properties. How much time I have? I have another, not much time. Okay, so just to confirm that the cholinergic network is perhaps sufficient to generate a wave, and we use the mouse from Lingang laboratory, which is a MEth5 knockout. MEth5 is a transcription factor, and if you knock out this gene, more than 97% of the ganglion cells are never differentiated. So in this retina, there's no retinal ganglion cell. And even though, as we know from the classic work, the retinal waves are measured from retinal ganglion cells. Now the ganglion cells are gone, the wave maintained. This is the wild-type wave, and this is the wave in MEth5, suggesting that indeed in the interneurons, such as Stabler's endocrine cells, will be sufficient to generate a wave. And the retinal ganglion cells are probably just reading out the activity in the endocrine cell layer without mature filter. Okay, so now we look at, so if you look at this recurrent synaptic excitation, which is actually quite dangerous. If you keep having this wave, then all you see is every minute you have waves popping up in front of you. And that's certainly not tolerable when the system is mature. So as I said, this activity in many parts of the brain, are found in many parts of the brain, and in most cases it's taken care of by the transition of GABAergic excitability. Early on, GABA is excitatory, and later they become inhibitory, so these waves die naturally. But in this case, it's different. Acetylcholine, you can never convert cholinergic synapse into inhibitory cholinergic synapse. So how does the Stabler cells do that? We found that this is right before the day before birth, that you double patch Stabler cells, you found the GABAergic transmission and the cholinergic transmission by holding the postsynaptic cell at different potentials. You can detect that. Now, 23 weeks later, what you found is that only the GABA currents are there. Cholinergic responses are gone. And the GABA currents are actually characteristically different. They are more prolonged and larger too. So it turned out that, and then we puff acetylcholine on the cells, and what we found is that the receptors simply disappeared quickly from about time of birth, dropped to a much lower level about a week later, and this is the time of eye opening. So the cholinergic cells, somehow they got rid of all those nicotinic receptors by the time of eye opening. And because of that, retinal waves cannot propagate. And we also look at the pacemaking activity of this cell. Now, as I mentioned, early in the postnatal rabbit, in the postnatal Stabler cells generate this rhythmic activity, and this is after you block all the synaptic transmission in the cocktail of antagonists. Now, a few days later, at the P8, a week after birth, the activity is gone. You can induce it by blocking some of the potassium currents using TEA. You can induce this activity, suggesting that the excitability is, the rhythmic activity is going down partially because there are more potassium channels expressed. In particular, this three KV3.1 channel that are expressed, we know, in the proximal parts of the Stabler's dendrites. And even in adult retina or mature retina, EP22, you put on TEA and a cocktail, this wave can be, activity can be induced again. Now, TEA itself is not enough. TEA blocking potassium channel, you don't induce this wave, but you have to use this cocktail to block all synaptic transmission. And we think, we didn't test that, but we're almost certain that the important part in this cocktail is the GABA blocker. So starburst amacrine cells receive a huge amount of inhibition, and that's something I'm going to talk about in the next half of the talk. So blocking GABA, reducing potassium channel, you can reproduce those rhythmic activity in the more mature retina. So this is just to summarize what we have. Early on, cholinergic cells talk to each other with acetylcholine and the GABA. Both are red, indicating that both are excitatory. And then after eye opening, this communication is gone, and the GABA become inhibitory. Now it's showing blue. So when we look at the starburst amacrine cell, other than those changes, what do we see morphologically is that the general structure is the same, but if you look at the details, the early, young starburst cell have all those filopodia sticking out. And that's part of the reason I think they might release acetylcholine, and because it's sticking out the narrow strata, they can contact more cells, more ganglion cells, more amacrine cells. Perhaps that's used to propagate activity to more cells to generate the waves. Now, in the mature starburst cells, you see those filopodia are gone. And the cell, and in fact, the dendrite become very thin, and you can see a lot of swellings on the distal part, and which is something that David talked about yesterday, varicosities on starburst amacrine cells. And then just try to remember these cells overlap each other tremendously, and they form a cholinergic plexus showing red. If you use immunohistochemistry, you can see that all these loops formed by the starburst amacrine cells. And on this network lies another cell type that David again mentioned yesterday, is the direction selective ganglion cell. And you can see these cells, these cells seek out to make contacts with the cholinergic background. And this is something called direction selectivity, which was first discovered by Barrow and Levick in the 60s. And that is when these cells are, when a light bar is moving in one particular direction, these cells fire action potentials vigorously. And this is an on-off cell, so this is response to the leading edge of the bar, and this is the leading edge of the bar. This is response to the leading edge of the bar, this is response to the trailing edge of the bar. So it's the on-off response. And if you move the same bar in the opposite direction, the cell barely responds, and sometimes inhibited. So this has been used as a classic model for understanding neuronal computation, because so far we believe there are not many synapses involved in this. It only involves amacrine cells, this particular type of ganglion cells, and the bipolar cells. So a synapse of three types that produce this remarkable computation. And functionally it's useful. There are four types of on-off DS ganglion cells responsible having preferred directions in vertical and horizontal directions. And that's believed to be coupled to the four ocular muscles that control the eye movement in the four directions. And it has been proposed that this may be used for slow pursuit of object. And this signal from the DS cells are used as error signal. So when the object is moving, your eye is following, but there's a lag. There's always a lag between the movement of the object and the eye movement. And the difference is the slippage of the image on the retina. And this slippage is detected by the direction selective ganglion cells, and then indeed feedback onto the eye to control the muscle so the eye can catch up, so that you want to minimize this slippage. So the image is always focused on a particular part, such as the fovea or the central part of the retina. So that's the function of on-off. There's another type called on cells, which are having three directions, which again believed to be coupled to the three axes of the vestibular system, so that it might compensate the rotation of the eye during the head movement. So when the head is moving, the eye is moving, and then the relative movement is compensated by another type of direction selective ganglion cells called on-DS cells. So anyway, the model, the mechanism of DS cell was, the understanding of which has been made has been advanced significantly in early 2000, and partly by a paper by Frank Wilburn's lab, Friedman, and they discovered that when you record from these cells, when the object is moving in the preferred direction, you see a smaller GABA input. When the object is moving in the no direction, there's a larger GABAergic input. And the excitatory input is also slightly asymmetric in a reversed direction. So suggesting that indeed, as has been proposed for many years, direction selectivity is due to asymmetric inhibition. And particularly, these are GABAergic inhibition. And they proposed the model that starboard cells are connected to the direction selective ganglion cells only from the no side. So when the light is moving in the no direction, this starboard cell is excited, which releases GABA onto this direction selective ganglion cell, such that when the light eventually hits the receptive field center of this direction selective ganglion cell, the cell is already inhibited by the GABAergic input. And if you move the image or the object in the preferred direction, there is no GABAergic input from starboard cell from this side because of the asymmetric wiring, so that the cell doesn't respond. And that's the model. Now there are assumptions to this model. One is that in order for this to occur, the starboard cells themselves have to be directionally selective. Because if you imagine when the light comes this way, even though there's no leading inhibition from the starboard cell from this side, but when the light actually hits this starboard cell, it will release GABA too. You know, albeit a little delay, but when this terminal is excited directly by light, it will release GABA, which will inhibit the direction selective ganglion cell too. So in order for this model to work efficiently, this process of starboard cell has to be directionally selective. And that's indeed been shown by the beautiful work, the Denmark work, by Thomas Euler and Winfrey here. So in this Nature paper in 2002, they demonstrated that using two photon imaging, that indeed the starboard distal dendrites have properties, respond to light. This is slide similar to what you see yesterday, you saw yesterday, that the calcium signal in distal dendrite, but not the cell soma as measured by the voltages here, the distal dendrite, in the distal dendrite, the calcium signals are directionally selective. And that's another unique property. That's a unique property of a starburst amacrine cell. You have a cell that has different parts of the dendrite responding to light in different manners, suggesting that this cell is not a uniform cell. It's a collection of discrete, independent processing units in the periphery. And that has been suggested for many, many years by looking at the cell. Now, in order for this to occur, you cannot have long-range interactions within the cell, for example, action potential. And that's something we initially found, too. Before eye-opening, these cells generate calcium and generate sodium action potentials. But after eye-opening, sodium channel dropped, and the cell no longer fire action potential. So these cells, as I'm showing in the morphology, that have very thin dendrites, a lot of potassium channels on the dendrites, which act as insulator of the distal events from the cell body. So the distal events in the cannot be propagated effectively to the cell body and then onto another part. So each part of the dendrite is acting semi independently or electrotonically, they're independent. So how is a starboard cell generating the directional selective response in the distal dendrites? And there are, you know, this has been the study quite actively for the past few years. And the Winfrey has a nice, and Euler, Thomas Euler, had a nice theory about dendritic processing, voltage gated channels, amplifying signals when the excitation is going centrifugally from the soma to the distal dendrite by activating calcium currents by the voltage gradients on the dendrites. And that's more or less an intrinsic property of the cell that promotes excitation that goes from soma to the distal dendrite. That's a centrifugal motion. And certainly that accounts for the excitation going centrifugally. But we are interested in another aspect of it, and later you will see both of these aspects are working hand in hand. In fact, what we are looking at from the background that we look at the starburst interactions, we have always been impressed by the GABAergic inhibition onto the starburst cell. We want to see if this inhibition has anything to do with the directional response of the starburst cell. And this is in part motivated by the experiment done by Wilburn's lab initially. That is, when the starboard cell is connected from the null side, and when you do a apparent motion experiment, if you put a fresh light on this part of the direction selective ganglion cell, because there's no cholinergic input from this side, the cell doesn't generate any GABAergic input. Now, if you move the light into the center, you see a huge GABA release. Now, just a flashing it. So this is believed to be due to the activation of starboard cells, which release GABA onto the DS ganglion cell. And this also suggests that the GABA can be easily released by simply flashing a light in the distal dendrite. Now, if you do this trick by flashing this light first and then this light, creating an apparent motion in the preferred direction, what you see is the GABA response is much reduced, suggesting this large GABAergic input is suppressed from the preferred direction. So we believe this suppression is largely onto the starburst amacrine cell. And again, we did the similar recordings from double the neighboring starburst cells. We showed that the cells after eye opening, they still have reciprocal GABA inhibition, although acetylcholine inhibition, cholinergic interactions are gone. Now, this occurs in various configurations as long as the cells touch each other. You always have this reciprocal interaction. And if you look at the light response of the starburst amacrine cells by giving the rings to different size of annulus, you can see initially there's very little excitation or inhibition, but as the ring gets bigger, you can see a large excitation and inhibition. And the inhibition gets increased all the way to about the edge of the cell, shown by here. Now, at this point, you have a lot of inhibition and excitation. And when you go further beyond the periphery of the cell, excitation is gone, so the inhibition maintained for another distance. And if you plot the excitation and inhibition, and you see a center excitation and a surround inhibition displaced by a distance about 150 micron, that corresponds to the diameter or the radius of a starburst amacrine cell. So because of the anatomical evidence that they make so much co-fasciculation among starburst cells, we believe most of the GABAergic inhibition onto the starboard cell is from the neighboring starboard amacrine cell. So the reciprocal inhibition produces a very strong surround inhibition. And that's nothing new. This is basically center surround mechanism, and it's nothing fancy. And if you move the light, when you have a centripetal motion of the ring, you can see that the excitation actually starts a little, inhibition starts a little early and excitation follows. That's a delay of 150 micron as well. Now, when the light is moving centripetally and you don't no longer see a leading inhibition, so excitation occurs earlier. So basically, the starburst amacrine cell as a unit is a typical neuron which has center surround antagonism. But what's unique about this is the processing or the decision-making part of the cell is not at the soma. If the cell is making a decision at the soma, then this cell is symmetric completely, center surround. But because the decision-making part is locally, so at these protons where GABA and acetylcholine perhaps are released, and because the dendrites are very thin, so the communication between here is very poor. These units can function independently, producing what Winfrey describing the Nature paper, directional response. So we think this response is in part, the directionality is in part due to surround inhibition. And this is shown by well, at that time we didn't have a two photon microscope, so we did it in a different way by flashing a fluorescent light here, which can measure the calcium activity in the distal dendrite, which can also serve as a stimulus for the retina. So when you flash a light here, you excite the retina, you also measure the calcium. And then you do that by, okay, and you can measure the calcium in the distal dendrite. Sorry, let's skip that. And then we can put another light, which is not fluorescent light, just the regular light, visible light, on the surround, which by itself will not activate the dye. So this used as a conditional flash. So if we do this flash, followed by that, you can see this creates an apparent motion, a central petal motion. And if you measure the calcium signal from these cells, if you just do a test flash, you get this response. And if you proceed this test flash with a conditioning flash, producing an apparent central petal motion, the calcium response is reduced. And this is the baseline activity, and this is the fluorescence of the baseline fluorescence of the dye. So if you eliminate that, you see these two curves match exactly what Werbling found. That is, during apparent motion, this is recorded from the starboard cell, the calcium signals. And these are the GABA inputs onto the DS ganglion cell. So they match very well, suggesting that surround inhibition inhibits the starboard amacrine cells and reduces the GABAergic input from the starboard cell to the direction selective ganglion cells. So now this is summarized. So this part is summarized here that, as I already mentioned, the starboard cell is nothing but center surround cell. Because the decision-making part is in the periphery, then if you look at this part, then of course you have asymmetry. From here, light moving from here, you are dominated by excitation from bipolar cells. Light coming from here is dominated by inhibition from neighboring starboard cell. So a perfectly symmetric center surround and mechanism is converted to the edge into a very asymmetric excitation and inhibition, and then we believe produce part of the asymmetric or asymmetry or directionality of the starboard dendrites. So I hope we can talk about the last part of it. I don't know how much time we have. This is work, again, so this is direction selectivity, not between starboard cells, between starboard cell and the ganglion cells. And this is the model that, based on Werbring's finding, that starboard cells are connected to direction selective cells from different directions. So this cell will receive starboard input only from this direction, so the preferred direction of this cell will be naturally going this way. And the preferred direction of this cell will be going this way, because when the light moves this way, it will be inhibited by this starboard cell. So that's how you generate four preferred direction of direction selective ganglion cells. Now, this model has been very robust, but the data originally was based on six recordings from Werbring's lab, three in the preferred, three in the null direction. So there was some controversy whether this connectivity is really true. Winfrey yesterday, I mentioned that too. They tried to see from the anatomical point of view whether the synapses are made asymmetrically, and as you saw from the data, they are indeed made asymmetrically. But we want to go over to look at electrophysiologically to see if indeed these synapses are made asymmetrically, sort of extending from the six neurons that they recorded by the Werbring lab to, we extended to about 30, 40 cells, and that turned out to be true. But a more important question we want to address is, starboard cells release acetylcholine and the GABA. So this picture only depicts GABA interactions, and there's no cholinergic input here. And what's the question, what's the problem? And Werbring's double patch recordings didn't detect any cholinergic input. That makes the question quite puzzling, because what's the function of acetylcholine as a fast excitatory neurotransmitter in the retina? Does it function as a sort of a has a paracrine effect on affecting a lot of ganglion cells, or does it really mediate fast synaptic transmission? So these recordings, again, now instead of from a starburst, between starburst cells, we did from starburst and direction selective ganglion cells. We used the light stimulus to first to map out the receptor field center of the direction selective cell, and then find out the preferred and no direction, and then we choose starburst cells from either the preferred or no direction of the cell, and then do the double patch recordings. So what we found is, to make the long story short, is that indeed GABAergic input is asymmetric. If you patch a starburst cell from the preferred direction, the GABA current, if you aim it right, is zero. And that's what they found in the first three cells they recorded from. You get zero GABA current. But on the same cell, however, we find that cholinergic inputs are there. So the cell can provide a cholinergic input, but no GABAergic input. If you reverse the direction, in the null direction, you get acetylcholine input as well, but GABAergic input is very large. So there is a double asymmetry, or there's a double symmetry there, sort of. Cholinergic inputs are symmetric. GABAergic synapses are asymmetric. And if you go to intermediate direction, you get both. So this is highly unusual. Think about a cell, and from a developmental point of view, the ganglion cells start to seek out starburst amacrine cells and make synapses. It has to know the dendrite it contacts has a preferred direction, and that's a big puzzle. We still don't know yet how it finds that. But the net result is that the cell makes all these nice asymmetric connections. So this is just a statistics to show that what I have just said. Now, if you give light to a direction selective ganglion cell, what you find is that from the preferred direction, you have a nice excitatory input, and the inhibitory input is delayed. But in the null direction, the inhibitory input leads. And that's explained by the leading starburst cell inhibition that we talked about. One thing that we found strange or interesting is that this is the edge of the receptive field center. I think the excitatory input is from GABAergic bipolar cells. That makes sense because the bipolar cell input is very small onto the receptive field center. But if you think the cholinergic input is embedded in here, that should have a spatial extension because the cells are coming from the surround, and that's something we never saw. But here we show at least we can pharmacologically separate this excitatory input into cholinergic component, NMDA component, and the GABAergic component. And I'm not going to go through the detail, except to say that the cholinergic input is asymmetric, the red bars. Glutamatergic NMDA input is also asymmetric. The AMPA kinase input is not as much. AMPA kinase and NMDA are both subtypes of glutamate receptors. So functionally, we see that the cholinergic input is actually asymmetric, but anatomically, they're connected symmetrically. That can also be shown by apparent motion. If you give a light in the receptive field surround, you're not going to generate any excitation. And so the excitation, but if you stimulate the receptive field center on the edge, you do get a response, shown in gray. Okay, now if you do the apparent motion in the preferred direction, flashing this first and then number two, what you see, number two is enhanced. So the excitatory input is motion sensitive, and it's facilitated by in the preferred direction. If you do this in the reverse order from the null direction, you see actually the total input or cholinergic input is actually reduced. So acetylcholine by itself, and if you stimulate the cell in the periphery, in the surround, it doesn't produce a surround excitation. The surround excitation is silent. And the silent surround excitation, however, can facilitate a motion. So when the light gets to the receptive field center, the cholinergic excitation is enhanced. And there's also a reason for that. You know, you typically see center surround. Surround is always inhibitory. But in this case, surround is excitatory. If the surround is not silent, then you imagine the receptive field center is expanded. Right? That's bad for spatial resolution. So by doing this, you have a silent surround. The cholinergic signal can still facilitate motion signals, but by itself, it doesn't expand the receptive field center. So it wouldn't degrade the spatial resolution. That's something we think is unique for the starburst amacrine cell. Now, just a couple of more, a few more slides to show that the reason that GABA has a clear leading inhibitory surround, whereas acetylcholine is a silent surround, excitatory surround. So that suggests the release mechanism of acetylcholine in the GABA must be different. Okay, indeed, we show that if you reduce the calcium, coming back to your question, if you reduce the calcium from normal 1.5 millimolar to 0.2 millimolar, what you find is the GABA responses are maintained. Acetylcholine releases are completely abolished. As you can see here, this is in low calcium GABA, acetylcholine is gone. Now, if you plot the concentration dependence, you see that the GABA responses are affected. And so the activation threshold is shifted. But nevertheless, they maintain. Whereas this is GABA, I'm sorry. The acetylcholine response is completely abolished. So there is a different requirement on extracellular calcium, such that we believe that GABA is much easier to release than acetylcholine. And GABA release is not facilitated if you give two pulses that maintain about the same, and acetylcholine release is facilitated. So it has a higher demand on extracellular calcium, not necessarily intracellular calcium, but it could also be a higher demand on intracellular calcium, or higher has a special arrangement of the diffusion of calcium when it gets into the cell. Perhaps, for example, the calcium entry site is further away from the acetylcholine release site, so that you would require to pump the calcium, or you can repetitively stimulate the cell so that to get a full amount of acetylcholine release. And also, if you block different types of calcium channels, you have different effect on the release of acetylcholine and the GABA. In this case, you can see like blocking conotoxin, blocking any type of calcium channel block all the calcium, all the nicotinic transmission, but a lot of GABA transmission maintained. Whereas blocking the PQ type of channels, you reduce a lot of GABA peak responses, but acetylcholine release are at least partially maintained, suggesting again that the dependence on calcium channels are different for the two releases. We don't know the exact dependence of these release mechanism, but at least these data strongly suggest that the release of the two transmitters are regulated independently or differentially. Suggesting, again coming back to the early question, are the neurotransmitter released from the same vesicle or not? They cannot be released from the same vesicle if they're regulated differently. So we believe that the two neurotransmitters are released from two different vesicles. Whether the vesicles are from the same varicosity or not, that's a different issue. But the data suggests that the two transmitters are released by two packaging vesicles. Yeah, we haven't done that. You know, the Erwin Niels, all those classic experiments, biophysical experiments, have to be characterized. But you know, it's not just calcium influx. We think there's also perhaps intracellular calcium release or some other things that contributes to the release. That's right. So anyway, the two neurotransmitters are released differentially or regulated differentially. So this is our model currently. The starburst amacrine cells make synapses, both cholinergic and GABAergic synapses onto direction selective ganglion cells. The GABAergic synapses shown blue are asymmetric. It's only made from the node direction, not from the preferred direction. But the cholinergic synapses are symmetric anatomically. So when the light moves from the side, before it reaches the ganglion cell, there's no cholinergic input to the ganglion cell, and that's the silent cholinergic excitation. So the red dots become silent, become simple. So if you cannot see here, we just show it as a circles. However, when the line moves this way, these GABAergic synapses are strengthened, actually. So you have a motion leading inhibition onto the DSL. So this provides most of the mechanism for direction selectivity. But when the light eventually reaches the receptive field center, then the cholinergic synapses is enhanced or facilitated. And so this signal is used to detect motion sensitivity. But the motion sensitivity is highly linked to a GABAergic system, such that these synapses are somehow inhibited. So if the light moves from the null direction, the cholinergic facilitation is no longer there. And that points to another different levels of computation from the original model. That is, we believe the starboard cells make GABAergic synapse onto ganglion cell from both directions. And the release of this acetylcholine is somehow regulated, and most likely by inhibition, GABAergic inhibition from another cell. And most likely this another cell is a starboard amacrine cell, such that when the light moves in the null direction, this synapse is inhibited. And this, the reason for this model is that if you block GABA, then acetylcholine release is become symmetric, and it's huge, actually. And in addition, so I mentioned the fact that starboard amacrine cell receive a lot of inhibition, and some of it is tonic inhibition. And I can show, so this slide shows that. You can look at the cholinergic component to the starboard cell, and usually it's restricted to the receptive field center. But once you put on GABA blocker, the input is huge and it's expanded. So this silent surround is removed, and the silent surround is largely maintained by GABAergic inhibition onto the starboard cell. So to sum up what I have said today is that before I open, the starboard cells are coupled to each other with acetylcholine and the GABA, and the cells function as more or less a single unit. The whole cell goes up and down when the wave comes or goes. And the cell itself is pacemaking. So this is used to produce a network to mediate retinal waves. After eye opening, there is a switch, many switches actually. Nicotinic receptors disappear here, sodium channel disappear from the starboard cell, and then GABAergic interactions are strengthened. And this GABAergic interaction contributes to the direction selective response, especially when the light is moving centripetally from the surround onto the cell, which we think is actually quite critical, because now we know that the GABA release is very easy onto the starboard cell. The key for the starboard cell to be direction selective is to somehow block this release, not to facilitate the release, because it doesn't need to be facilitated, it just needs to be blocked. And this blocking of GABA release, we believe, is from the neighboring starboard cell. And then also between the starboard and the DS ganglion cells, there are also connections. And this connection uses both acetylcholine as the excitatory transmitter and the GABA as the inhibitory transmitter. Now the excitatory transmitter is connected anatomically symmetrically, but functionally asymmetrically by a presynaptic suppression of this release, which is again coming from the starboard cell. But the GABAergic interaction is by default designed to be completely asymmetric from anatomical point of view. So I want to stop this by acknowledging the people. Sung Hong Lee has been a fantastic graduate student and now a postdoctoral fellow in the lab. DJ did the pacemaking activity, and Kyoming Kim is a graduate student who is working on something exciting and looking at the development of the asymmetry in the starboard amacrine cell, or DS ganglion cell, which I don't have time to talk about. And the rest of the people worked on various aspects of waves. And the Lin Gang is the one we got MAS5 mouse, and these are the other people and the funding from the NIH. Thank you. Okay. Okay, you go first. Yeah.
Can you just maybe give some oversight as to, I mean, here the sometimes directional selectivity already in the retina, but if you open up a textbook, you could talk about already SELDM, which they couldn't find, but already in V1, they're worried about it. And how does the visual system sort of divvy up where it pulls these features apart? I mean, is there something special about the rabbit retina that
Yeah, in rabbit, this direction selectivity was initially studied in rabbit. This is a very robust preparation. It's avascular and survives very well in vitro. But now direction selectivity has been found almost similarly in the mouse retina, suggesting this is not a rabbit species. And it's actually, we don't know direction selective ganglion cells in the primate, but we know the stable cells are there. Okay, so the mechanism is there. This cell type, we believe, is probably is used for early stage of motion detection, and it's very much linked to visual behavior rather than visual perception. So it's going through the, in the case of RDS cell, it goes to superior colliculus and also to the LGN, interestingly. There is a projection to LGN. So there is a possibility providing some kind of directional information to the cortex. This is not clear. I mean, this is not known, but the thing that's known very well for the RDS cell is going to the optic accessory center, which is usually for eye movement. So if in the primate, it would be grouped into W cell, but I don't know, I'm not aware of, I don't know if Winfrey knows any DS ganglion cell being detected in the primate, but the Stauber cells are definitely have a similar morphology and anatomy, so I assume there will be few ganglion cells, but might be, should still be there in the primate that does this. Yes. Yeah. So direction selective ganglion cell in the retina is a very robust phenomenon. It detects, you know, and that's why we shouldn't be surprised that multiple mechanisms are built together to produce this phenomena. So if you look at the DS cell, it's about 300 micron diameter. And the thing is, it can detect motion within the dendritic field. So if you have a spot in the dendritic field of the DS cell, there's a blind spot. I mean, there's a motion, there's a direction insensitive area. But other than that, the cell can detect motion within the dendritic field. So it's much smaller. Could be down to 50 micron or, you know, 100 micron, 50 micron, 100 micron, I think. And that would be corresponding to 1 degree, I think, or a little less than 1 degree.
Yeah, it seems like a very small,
oh, the kinds of eye movements.
I'm just sort of wondering about given the spatial scale of the direction selectivity, what might the functional world be? And my understanding, and maybe I think the numbers on one, the magnet, the amplitude of motion is beautiful to the fact that it's small.
Well, the eye movement, I think the eye movement can certainly be accounted for that, by that. You have many, and the ganglion cells, again, tiles, the four subtypes of ganglion cells tile the retina, and then they're detecting motion in four directions. So, yeah, then you would have to integrate signals from the ganglion cells, sort of compare the timing of the different ganglion cells. You need another circuit to do that, but this is completely computed in the retina. In fact, you know, what they did is that they killed the Stauber's amacrine cells. The first thing they found is the OKN, ocular kinetic movement of the eye, is gone. So that's the, so far, the strongest evidence that this is the linked to the eye movement.
What's the speed tuning?
The speed tuning, yes. So for the on-off DS ganglion cell, it has a fast speed tuning. The degree we tested, something like that. And the on-DS cell has somewhere like 3 degrees per second. That's corresponding very well with the slow eye movement, slow pursuit. The on-DS cell is a little faster, so there's some debate whether they are really used are used for eye movement. But as it tapers off between somewhere between 3 degrees and 10 degrees, probably the on-off DSL plays a role for this.
One further question. Initial pattern you get developing a wave pattern you see moving through, that looks an awful lot of like a moving edge that might trigger directional selectivity. Do you think that is part of the process that generates the asymmetry?
Yeah. That's obviously a fascinating question, and people looked at that. Malafella looked at a transgenic mouse where the waves are at least one stage, and those are stage the cholinergic waves are eliminated by knocking out the nicotinic receptor subunit, and they found the direction selectivity to be maintained. And then actually. I think my student probably just sent me, I received some phone calls and she was supposed to send me some slides to show that early on, at the very onset of the transition time, or before even the transition time, when the ganglion cell and the starboard cell make contacts, early contacts, initial contacts, we already saw evidence of asymmetry, suggesting this is probably molecularly driven rather than activity driven. Yeah. He's first. Yes.
So this is just kind of normalization where you know, you have one channel being total motion and the opposing channel being motion in the same direction. So have you thought about that idea? And are there specific examples, let's say, where you change the contrast?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So this is an interesting question. You know, there's this idea of the cell release to transmitter, which is not very usual, but it's not. You know, after so many years, the Dell's principle has been disapproved in many systems. So the cold neurotransmission is not a strange phenomenon, but it's nevertheless quite unusual. So there's this thought about evolutionary maybe acetylcholine develops early. So it's used for motion sensitivity. And the GABA system may be developed a little later. It's sort of a piggyback onto this to add directional sensitivity to the motion sensitivity. That's just a hypothetical thought about this. So now in terms of the actual contribution, and so this is quite debate. I mean, I actually just got an email this morning. The last part is just accepted to Neuron. Even in the second review, they still ask the question of what's the cholinergic input to direction, function to direction selectivity. You know, it's known that if you block acetylcholine receptors, direction selectivity is fine. So it doesn't really need acetylcholine. But you know, Grivash's lab have shown that under certain conditions, if you use grading, for example, rather than those bars, then the cholinergic contribution is more. So it's possible that under certain condition, and especially when acetylcholine release is requiring those repetitive stimulation, if you see those gradings keep coming, then you may get a better cholinergic input to it. And another thing, we talk about the contribution of acetylcholine to direction selectivity is that it's not that acetylcholine doesn't do anything to DS. The DS cells are affected tremendously. The spiking rate is blocked more than 50% if you block nicotinic receptor. It's the ratio that you define direction selective index, and that remains. So then now the question is, what is the direction selective index a real representation of the physiology of the ganglion cell or different? I mean, I would assume it's not the complete representation of direction selectivity, because when the brain sees the direction selective ganglion cell comes in, when the light moves in the preferred direction, it fires 50 spikes versus 150 spikes. The brain must be interpreting differently, even though the no motion produces zero responses. Because the no motion produces zero responses, the ratio is always one. You know, you have in the extreme case, direction selective index is very high, but the actual amount of spikes in the preferred direction can make a difference, and that could convey some motion information by still coding. Okay.